Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board, stepping in as guest host. Today's show is about the youngest people impacted by drug addiction, babies. One mom says she prayed for her unborn baby to be okay.
When she was in my stomach, I was terrified that something would be wrong and that she would have some sort of issues, you know?
But some women who struggle with drug addiction say they're afraid to go to the doctor when they become pregnant. Some even say they've been turned away.
They don't trust anybody. You know, they're embarrassed. And so many times we have heard from them, you're the first person that would listen, or you're the first person that I've told this to.
In this show, we'll hear the science. What do doctors say is the best way to treat unborn babies when they've been exposed to drugs? That and more this week, Inside Appalachia. First, this news.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia Farmers Markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. Because opioid addiction is changing families across Appalachia, today we're diving into a topic that is heartbreaking, but critically important for us to spend some time understanding. Our show is dedicated to all the children who are affected by substance use before they're even born. We'll find out how doctors are learning new ways to treat expecting mothers who are dealing with addiction and how to help babies who suffer from neonatal abstinence syndrome, which babies often go through when they're exposed to drugs in the womb. In this episode, we'll be referring to this condition as NAS. In the wake of the ongoing surge of substance use disorders, thousands of grandparents are stepping in to raise grandchildren as their own children are caught up in addiction, incarcerated, or dead from a drug overdose. Lisa Robbins and her husband were starting to look toward retirement. Then Lisa's daughter Molly became addicted to opioids.
She got caught using drugs shooting up in her vehicle in a convenience store parking lot. And at that time, she was about 4 months pregnant.
And now they're raising Molly's daughter.
My job was to be a grandmother, but my job now is a mother to my grandchild. And that's hard.
The Robbins family lives in East Tennessee, about an hour south of Knoxville. Jess Mador brings us their story.
A wood-framed house perches atop a rise at the end of a long, winding driveway near Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Mist rises in the distance. It's early on a Sunday morning, and the cool air is a country chorus of birds, frogs, cows, and chickens. Children's toys, freshly chopped firewood, and a chicken coop sit in the yard. On a car in the driveway, a license plate displays a verse from the Bible, John 3:16. For God so loved the world, he gave his one and only son. The screen door opens. Lisa Robbins comes out to the front porch. She wears a black, white, and coral patterned dress with matching necklace and earrings. She's dressed up for church.
They say for ladies that are aging, since I'm 50, not to wear much eyeshadow, so I'm going to get the lips covered. So I just now got her dressed.
Lisa points to 2-year-old granddaughter Adeline Grace, who the family calls Addie. Addie's dressed up too, in a duckling yellow dress, black Mary Janes, and matching black bow in her shoulder-length hair.
Brent and Adeline and I live here with our 2 dogs and our 4 chickens. You can come on in. Mom's in the kitchen, of course.
Inside, Lisa and her mom, Linda, are a blur, packing plastic bags and coolers.
See, yes. The ice pack in here, okay. I put the coleslaw on it.
Mom and I went to the grocery store last night and got stuff for cookout.
Today is a special day. More than 3 dozen relatives are meeting them at church for Addie's dedication ceremony.
A dedication is where the parents and grandparents in this situation are committing to raising Adeline to love the Lord and to raise her in church. And you look at that child and her not have any significant defects, by all accounts, that she should have. NAS, NICU visits, you look at her, you know God's touched her. I didn't want to raise another child, and I feel guilty for that. But I'm a Christian woman, so I started praying. I said, God, you show me what I need to do.
Lisa takes care of Addie full-time and holds down a full-time job in Knoxville. She remembers the moment she realized her daughter Molly was pregnant.
And there was no other option but for me to take care of Adeline, to help in any way I could. And so now we have Adeline, and to look back, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Addie, do you want milk or juice?
Can you tell me?
Good job. Good girl. Give me five.
Lisa says it helps to talk about Molly's addiction. That's how she recently discovered Addie isn't the only child in her congregation whose mother used drugs during pregnancy.
And it actually opened a door for another family in our church to bring to the forefront that their daughter had an addiction problem. That mom came up to me and she said, "How are you so vocal?" And I said, "How can I not be vocal when, you know, this is my church family. I need to share it, and I may help somebody one day. Molly may help somebody one day."
Are you ready to go to church, Addie? Mom, we're going on downstairs to the van. Okay.
Lisa leads Addie down the narrow steps to the garage and into the minivan with Lisa's parents.
Are we ready?
Yes, sir.
The van motors up the steep driveway. At the top, it turns right to make the short trip past cows and farm fields to Cagley's Chapel Baptist Church. The church is red brick with a white steeple. A sign at the front door dates the original building to the 1880s. Along the side runs a small cemetery of gravestones, silhouetted against the shadow of a mountain ridge in the distance. The family heads inside for the dedication ceremony. A large stage is decorated with flowers. Above it is a projector screen announcing the dedication. A giant illuminated cross hovers over center stage. Lisa joins her husband, Brent, Molly, her other daughter, and family members in the pews as the ceremony begins.
Father, we ask for a special blessing on these moms and dads and these children that are going to be coming in just a few moments for this dedication service.
A live band with piano plays a few numbers, and Pastor David Hammons opens with a prayer.
Father, we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.
One by one, the pastor invites the families on stage and prays over each child.
The next child that we are dedicating to the Lord is Adeline Bayless.
Then it's Adeline's turn. The pastor calls the Robbins family to the front of the stage. They hold each other with Addie at the center and bow their heads together to pray.
God, we pray for this family, that you would just help them to grow. In Jesus' name we pray.
And with that, the ceremony wraps up. Outside, after the dedication, Adeline's mother Molly and an old friend grab some fresh air in the parking lot. Molly says it took a long time for her to feel comfortable around her family again after Addie was born.
And know that they were going to love me. And I still get scared that people are going to judge me of my past. But at the end of the day, I know my daughter loves me.
Molly is tall in a white shirt and rust-colored vest, black pants, and cowboy boots. Her long, dark hair is pulled back from her face. She fights back tears as she recalls being pregnant with Addie.
I was so scared for her to bring her into this world. When she was in my stomach, I was terrified that something would be wrong and that she would have some sort of issues, you know? Because if it weren't for all the prayers that I had, God only knows what would be wrong with her. But He protected her. Because I put so much horrible stuff into my body and hers.
Molly's drug use started in high school, she says. She was one of the party girls. But things quickly got serious. One night in her car, Addie's dad overdosed on fentanyl.
Then I look over and he's turning gray. And I was like, oh my God. And so I called 911. Luckily, they had brought him back. Then a few weeks later, I found out that I was pregnant. So it was a very scary thing. I was like, okay, I'm going to quit. I couldn't quit.
Molly says his overdose was a wake-up call, but as her addiction escalated, she cycled into and out of jail. She worried the drugs she took would harm her baby. Her parents took her to a doctor in Knoxville who specializes in treating women with opioid addiction. Molly credits the clinic with saving her life.
They just embraced me and loved me through it. It was like I was telling my family, hey, I have a problem and I don't know how to fix it. And they helped me.
Since then, there have been many new beginnings for Molly. She turned 24 in May and started a new job. But relapse, she says, is an ever-present fear. Children play on a nearby swing set as Molly's stepdad loads up his car to leave. Brent Robbins says he wasn't sure today would ever come.
There were times I wondered if
we were going to be having a service at a graveyard instead of a dedication service in church.
Brent says he lost a lot of sleep during Molly's pregnancy, worrying she might overdose. His stepdaughter's addiction has taken a toll on his family in other ways, too, he says.
It's cost her mom and I some money. I mean, it's cost us a lot of money to put her through drug rehab and stuff, $5,000 out of our savings. And I'm 54. I'm looking forward to retiring. But that's $5,000 less. It's part of it, though. If it saved her from overdosing, then it was worth it.
Working full-time while also being a dad all over again at his age, he says, can be tough. But Brent says he wouldn't change a thing.
Because Addie is my whole world. I mean, when you come home from work and you got a little girl running to the top of the steps hollering, "Papa, Papa, Papa," that's something that I can't describe.
That was Brent Robbins, who is raising his grandchild, Addie. That story was produced by Jess Mador, who joins me now to talk about her reporting. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Glynis. Thanks for having me.
So it sounds from that story that Addie is doing really well. She seems to have managed so far to be relatively unscathed, despite being exposed to her mother's addiction in utero. You were there collecting these interviews back in March, and I understand that since then there have been some updates in their story.
There have. Molly has relapsed. When I was there, the Robbins family was optimistic. Molly was optimistic. She was doing really well. She had her first job in a long time, and she was doing well, and everyone was feeling hopeful about her recovery. But she did relapse, and her mother told me that while, of course, it was a disappointment, it wasn't entirely unexpected because, as we know, often relapse is part of recovery from opioid addiction. Before Addie was born, Molly had detoxed completely. She went to this specialized clinic in Knoxville at the University of Tennessee Medical Center, where the staff, doctors and nurses, are highly specialized in treating women and babies who've been exposed to opioids.
Oh, wow. I know there is such a heavy stigma attached there. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, we saw this with the crack epidemic and the stigma that surrounded so-called crack babies. And then today, we're seeing very similar thing with the opioid epidemic fueling these fears over neonatal abstinence syndrome. There's so much that we don't know. So how is this clinic dealing with that stigma?
It's a major part of what they do at the clinic, in the sense that it's really important to Dr. Towers and the other physicians and nurses there that women don't feel the stigma, that they feel welcome to come to the clinic, they feel supported, they feel understood, and they don't feel judged. And the whole idea is that women will be able to come without fear to their appointments so that they can get the prenatal care that they need and the drug treatment so that they can deliver healthy babies, hopefully without NAS.
Right. Wow. So you went and you visited with Molly's doctor, Dr. Craig Towers, there in Knoxville. Let's go ahead and listen to the story that you produced out of that clinic.
Paper rustles on a clinic exam table at the University of Tennessee Medical Center in Knoxville. The table is just a few feet long, a perfect size for babies. One-month-old Caden is here for a checkup. It's the baby's first exam since leaving the hospital's newborn intensive care unit. Pediatric nurse practitioner Amber Knapper greets the baby's mom as she starts the exam.
So, do you have any concerns since going home?
I do not, really.
Good, awesome.
Baby Caden is asleep in her car seat with a pink pacifier in her mouth. She's dressed in pink socks, flowery leggings, and a bright yellow polka dot top. She wakes up as she's unbuckled for the exam. Knapper places the baby gently on a scale to check her weight.
I know. This is going to be cold. Have you noticed any tremors, tight muscles?
Tight muscles and tremors. They're among a long list of symptoms connected to neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, a condition affecting some babies who are born in withdrawal from opioids their mothers use during pregnancy. When she was born, Caden weighed 6 pounds 7 ounces and was at risk of NAS. This clinic at the University of Tennessee Medical Center is called High Risk Obstetrical Consultants, and Knapper is part of an expert team specializing in treating opioid-affected women and babies.
Any spitting up, any gagging?
I think she has spit up maybe 3 times since I've had her.
any medications that she's on?
Napper has lots of questions for this mom. She asks about Caden's appetite, breastfeeding, and sleep patterns. This clinic is tracking the baby's progress for a new study on the impacts of NAS.
She had no NAS. She was observed for 3 days because mom was on naltrexone.
Naltrexone is a drug that blocks the high of opioids to prevent relapse after detox.
Not only do we want to see all the babies back that did have NAS and were in the NICU and treated, we also want to see these babies that did not have NAS, and we want to see how well they do. We want to compare. She looks great. I don't feel any tightness. I don't see any tremors. I know, there it is.
Napper says the baby still shows no signs of NAS, but she says she wants to keep a close eye on her for the next few years to make sure she develops as she should.
Okay.
Anything else?
I don't think so.
Perfect.
Afterwards, in the exam room, Caden's mom, Callie Relford, says she's grateful her daughter is so healthy.
It's wonderful, really. And still to this day, I feel really good, like physical and health-wise and everything like that, with knowing where I came from and what I was doing to now, it's great.
Rocking the baby in her arms, the 28-year-old recalls her addiction to pain pills.
It was horrible. I had pretty much nothing. I had no roof over my head. I lived outside for, I want to say, maybe 4 years straight. I had no family relationships, no trust, actually no friendships.
She found out she was pregnant and was incarcerated.
When I got there, I was like, I'm not about to have this child in jail. And so that's why, you know, I needed to turn myself around and make sure she was okay and to keep her.
She was almost 6 months pregnant when a jail program sent her to the clinic in Knoxville for prenatal care. Relford says she worried the drug she took would hurt her baby. After going through detox, she started on naltrexone to block her cravings. Detox for pregnant women is safe, says Dr. Craig Towers. He's a physician who specializes in maternal fetal medicine.
There's no data to say that it harms the baby or results in a poor pregnancy outcome.
In the U.S., most obstetricians recommend medically assisted treatment over detox. The current protocol for pregnant women addicted to opioids is to prescribe them maintenance drugs such as methadone, an opioid. That gets them off dangerous street drugs such as heroin and fentanyl, but the treatment itself still carries a risk of NAS. The medical literature doesn't convince Towers detox during pregnancy should always be out of the question. He didn't always feel this way. Towers says in the last few years, he saw a need for more treatment methods after hearing the stories of dozens of desperate pregnant women searching for help with opioid addiction.
And I would tell them, like everyone else, that it's not recommended to taper or detox off of opiates because, in theory, it could cause a stillbirth and harm the baby and lead to poor pregnancy outcome. Well, what I found out was that was based on 2 case reports.
So Towers decided to launch his own studies to test the safety of detox during pregnancy.
All I'm asking for is that women be given the choice.
That view could be considered controversial. In the U.S., detox during pregnancy has long been seen as risky for expectant mothers and infants. One reason is concern over relapse. To help prevent it, Towers Clinic provides continuing care and other outpatient treatment to support women throughout their pregnancies and for at least 6 months to a year after their babies are born. Offering medical, prenatal, pediatrics, and mental health services all in one place is especially critical for this high-risk patient population, he says.
Almost all the women who don't show up to my appointment will call and apologize and reschedule because they don't have a ride.
Lack of transportation is a big problem in East Tennessee, Towers says. The clinic is pushing to make it easier for patients who don't drive to keep their prenatal care appointments and continue their recovery from addiction. The doctor has studied substance abuse in pregnancy since the crack cocaine crisis of the 80s, but Towers says the severity of Appalachia's opioid epidemic is eye-opening.
I was amazed at how many patients I had in our high-risk OB clinic that were addicted to opiates, much more than I had where I was from previously at that time, which was Wisconsin.
Towers advises his patients it's up to them whether they choose to detox completely or stay on medically assisted treatment during pregnancy. It's important they find a path to recovery and get off street drugs as quickly as possible, he says.
Now, I have probably tapered off and detoxed over 700, maybe over 800, without a loss, knock on wood.
Towers is hoping his results convince the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists that detox during pregnancy is a safe option for many women. He recently published research suggesting developmental delays in some babies exposed to opioids, including both prescription drugs like buprenorphine and methadone, and street drugs like heroin.
Some of them have cognitive problems, some of them have visual dysfunction, and we don't know why some babies don't exhibit that problem and others do.
Towers says the long-term effects of neonatal abstinence syndrome are subject to debate in some corners of the medical community. It could take a decade before researchers fully understand the far-reaching impacts of NAS for babies.
You want to do Vivitrol today?
Yes.
Okay.
Back inside the consulting room, Callie Relford, the mom we met at the beginning of this story, is finished with her daughter's exam. Now it's Relford's turn to check in with substance abuse coordinator Emily Katz. Katz works closely with all of Dr. Towers' patients at risk of delivering babies with NAS before and after they give birth.
No opiates, nothing, no relapses.
No.
All right, I'm gonna grab your blood pressure.
Kat says she looks forward to seeing Relford at the clinic again soon.
I need to make sure you come in every month, every 25 to 28 days.
Okay.
Okay? If you don't come in, I'll come hunt you down. Okay? Nowhere to find you.
You're doing great.
Thank you.
Clinics like this one in Knoxville that offer both a detox option and medically assisted treatment are hard to find. Some of the women we spoke to for this story say they felt judged by other doctors in the past. Many described being turned away from treatment because they used drugs. And patients travel to the Knoxville clinic from all across the South to get help. Some come from as far away as West Virginia, Georgia, North Carolina, and Alabama. Many more come from small communities across East Tennessee. They're vulnerable, Kat says.
They don't trust anybody. You know, they're embarrassed. And so many times we have heard from them, you're the first person that would listen, or you're the first person that I've told this to.
Katz lost her own brother to an overdose not long ago. She says the clinics taught her relationships are key to preventing relapse among pregnant women struggling with addiction and preventing NAS in their infants. Patients need someone to have their back through recovery, Katz says.
They literally have burned either bridges with everybody or everybody in their family is actively using. So we become like family.
That was Emily Katz, who helps women who are new mothers or who are pregnant in their ongoing recovery of opioid addiction. Jess Mador produced this story and has been looking into this debate regarding how doctors are treating pregnant women. Is it safe to let them detox without medication? Jess, I gather from the interview that not everyone in the medical community is in agreement on this subject.
That's true. The standard is to keep pregnant women struggling with opioid addiction on medically assisted treatment, so MAT, you know, drugs like methadone. And that's the standard across the country.
And I know that many people argue that the best way to prevent babies from being exposed to drugs, period, is to keep women from having unwanted pregnancies if they do suffer from substance use disorder, right?
Yeah, and the state has rolled out a number of prevention programs. One of them is all about educating women about contraception options and reaching women where they are, the highest risk women. And many times these women are serving time in jails.
Wow. I know you spent some time speaking with some of these women who've been serving time. One woman in particular, Autumn Melton, spoke with you at length, who's serving some time on drug-related charges. Talk to me a little bit about Autumn and her story.
She's 33, and she's there on drug-related charges as well. And she told me that she has really strong opinions about neonatal abstinence syndrome and addiction. She's got a lot of experience with both of these things in her own family, and her sister has had multiple children who were born drug-exposed.
My experiences, everything I've been through with my sister, makes me very conscious of it, that I should never be at risk of bringing a child into the world under those circumstances.
Autumn says, you know, one of her sister's kids was actually born inside a Tennessee prison, and she gave birth to another child after that, and that child was adopted.
The one that was born in prison was a nephew. He was very underdeveloped when he was born. He had to have a feeding tube, and the original couple that planned to adopt him wound up backing out of the adoption when they found out the complications that he had and the health issues that he had. She had actually four kids altogether. Her first two daughters, she doesn't have a relationship with them, but I do. My dad has a relationship with them. My dad's 84 years old. My sister's second daughter is 8 years old, and my dad has had custody of her since she was three, I think, since the first time my sister went to prison.
Did you have a chance to talk with Autumn about what she hopes for her future?
So Autumn is serving a 3-year sentence, and she's got a lot of that left. But she's thinking about one day when she gets out and gets back on her feet, she wants to start some kind of a halfway house program for women. She says she wants to help other women who've struggled with drugs and maybe have kids to find a way out of addiction and avoid giving birth to babies with neonatal abstinence syndrome. And she says she wants to start this halfway house because there are just so few programs dedicated to women in this situation. And so often a lot of them will just end up back behind bars in jail because they don't have anywhere else to go and they don't really know what to do. So Autumn says it's her dream to try and break this cycle in East Tennessee with a special program for women.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate your reporting on this very tough subject, Jess Mador. Thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jess's reporting is part of a project called Born Exposed. It's a collaboration between West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 100 Days in Appalachia, and the Ohio Valley Resource. You can find out more online. So not all doctors agree on the best method for treating opioid-dependent pregnant women. Some states hardest hit by the opioid crisis have begun to put together protocols for the best way to care for these moms-to-be and their babies. But as Carol Lofton reports, standards can still vary from state to state and even facility to facility.
If you ask state departments of health and human resources, are there standards of care that all facilities treating opioid-dependent pregnant women have to follow? The short answer is...
No, there are not exact protocols on how to do that.
That's Dr. Connie White, Deputy Commissioner for the Kentucky Department of Public Health.
I think you have to do that like you treat anyone with a substance use disorder. It's very individualized.
Part of the challenge with having exact protocols for pregnant and parenting women is that women in this stage of life have unique needs that are often more complex.
Well, the challenges have more to do with barriers to care, such as access to those services, including where treatment programs are located or, in our case, not located, as well as other factors related to the population, such as childcare and transportation.
Janine Braille is the Director of Substance Use and Pregnancy Initiatives for the West Virginia Perinatal Partnership.
But in terms of the care itself, it's, I think, fairly straightforward to get a woman on either methadone or buprenorphine and then manage her prescription, her medication throughout her pregnancy.
The current federal standards for caring for opioid-dependent pregnant women call for using medication-assisted treatment as the standard of care. Yet, many providers balk at prescribing medication to pregnant women. White again.
The medical community is sometimes a little frightened of pregnant women, and the behavioral health community is no different. You're taking care of two patients at the same time instead of one, and so people have to have certain services in place to assist these women. So we are slowly but surely increasing that capacity across our state.
White says Kentucky currently has about 17 treatment facilities that will accept pregnant women and are in the process of working with existing facilities to expand beds for that population. But there are 120 counties in Kentucky. Not many have facilities that will take pregnant women. So some obstetricians and general practitioners have started offering medication-assisted treatment to their patients. But even that is a process.
As a retired physician, I can say that sometimes stigmatization is not out in the community as much as it can be in the medical and the healthcare system. So trying to educate people, and this has been 4 years ago, the importance of understanding that this is a chronic relapsing disease and that it is our role to help these women do as much harm reduction as possible and teach them parenting skills that many of them didn't even experience as children, because traumatic childhood is a common theme among people who are suffering some substance use disorder.
Meanwhile, Virginia, which hasn't been hit quite as hard by the opioid epidemic as West Virginia and Kentucky, is in the process of developing and implementing a plan of services for pregnant women and families impacted by opioid use. The Virginia Department of Health had 3 meetings with over 100 stakeholders, partners, and families, and are hoping to develop a statewide network so that they know what resources they have, who offers them, and where to refer women who need them.
Because essentially we want no wrong door. So no matter what door they come in, if this is identified as a need for the family, that is seamless and can happen.
Shannon Purcell is the maternal and infant health coordinator for the Virginia Department of Health.
So adequate screening, then, you know, diagnosis, referral, treatment, et cetera.
Both Kentucky and West Virginia have their own versions of this network. But growing it so that there are adequate resources available for those who need them is an ongoing process. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Kara Lofton.
Kara is our Appalachia Health News reporter, which is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from CAMC and Marshall Health. Despite so many obstacles like trauma and the physical impacts of being born exposed to drugs, children can be resilient. But helping them means getting them into a stable, loving home. How does the opioid epidemic affect the foster care system? We hear thoughts on that after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Ward, and we'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Hey, I wanted to let you know about a show that we want your help with, Ghost Stories and Legends in Appalachia. For the past 5 years, we've had an annual tradition of doing a special episode for Halloween. Last year, we teamed up with the West Virginia Humanity Council's Folklife Program to find more stories from across our region. We produced an episode called Werewolves, Panthers, and Ghosts, Oh My, Appalachia. One of the highlights was where listeners recorded their own stories and sent them to us. So here's your homework. Think back to a family legend, scary story, or tale of terror. Then, using your voice memo app on your smartphone, record it. Do your best to get it in one take. You may want to practice or make some notes before you hit record. But if you can't, no worries. We can totally trim out some false starts and whatnot. Your stories should be no more than 3 minutes long. The shorter, the better. The deadline is October 11th. Or, if technology isn't your thing, you can call the West Virginia Folklife Program's hotline and leave a voicemail. Leave your contact information in case we need to call you back. That number, ready? 1-844-618-3747. Again, that's 1-844-618-3747. If you have any questions, you can also send us an email at insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. The number of babies across the country who suffer from NAS has increased in the past several years, according to national and state health officials. Those reports indicate that the numbers are among the highest in Central Appalachia. 5 out of every 100 babies born in West Virginia have NAS, up from 3% in 2013. In 2016, there were over 1,200 babies born with NAS in Kentucky. That's more than 100 cases each month. And many of these children wind up in foster care or with relatives. There are about 7,000 children in foster care in West Virginia, says Bill Couch, Cabinet Secretary of the state's Department of Health and Human Resources.
We recognize we have a child welfare crisis in this state. We have had to take children and keep them in overnight in a hotel or motel somewhere close.
This means children sometimes stay in a hotel with a social worker or even inside a state office on a cot or a blow-up mattress. And in Kentucky, about 100,000 children are being raised by people other than their parents, a number that puts Kentucky above all other states. A lot of these cases stem from opioid epidemic-related issues like incarceration, abuse, or neglect. And many grandparents are raising these children. Side Effects Public Media's Lisa Gillespie reports that this often puts grandparents in difficult situations in a state where many people live in poverty and have severe health issues.
Getting to Ann Polston's house is a journey. First, you have to get to Liberty, a town about 2 hours southeast of Louisville. Then there's a winding 8-mile road that's largely one lane and sometimes just gravel. At the end is Polston's 3-bedroom home, crammed with toys and VHS tapes and beaten-up furniture. Polston is raising 4 children, ages 2, 4, 8, and 16. But she's 51 years old, and their grandmother.
The 2 older ones call us Grandma and Papa, and the 2 babies say Mom and Dad.
The kids were born to Polston's stepdaughter, but when drug problems hit the parents, Polston and her husband got custody rights.
You know, as the saying goes, grandparents can spoil them and send them home. Well, we don't have that option unless we want to put them in foster home, and that's not an option for us. We don't want it.
But watching over 4 kids is taking a toll.
We're not spring chickens anymore. We can't keep running after them all the time, so it wears.
There's mixed research on how raising kids affects a grandparent, says Bert Hayslip, a University of North Texas professor. On one hand, grandparents might work longer and make decisions on the fly, improving cognition. But there's also a big downside.
Many grandparents seem to put their own needs behind those of the grandchildren. This includes medical and, for that matter, emotional needs in many cases.
Dr. John Fulton sees the impact at an outpatient mental health center at a local hospital.
They usually come in with complaints of either depression or stress/anxiety. They come in, some of them feeling guilty because they're aggravated at having to do this.
There are other problems, too. Polston has 2 slipped discs in her back from working at the post office. Back at her house, Polston picks up 2-year-old Sissy to change her pull-up.
Ouch! Ouch! Killing my back, kid.
In 2017, 63,000 children were in the care of grandparents in Kentucky. That's 6% of all kids in the state. And it's clear the opioid epidemic plays an outsized role. In a nationwide survey, that was the reason cited by 70% of grandparents who were raising grandkids. To help out, Polston and her friend Clydene Campbell formed the Alternative Parents Action Council. It's a support group that also teaches caregivers about available state benefits.
When social services gives you these children, they don't explain to you how to get the benefits or what you have to do.
Campbell is 58 and raising 4 of her sister's grandchildren.
And I mean, I love the children, but it's really hard at my age. I tell everybody all the time, I don't remember being a mother being this hard.
The state offers limited resources, like some money and daycare assistance, unless grandparents go through a rigorous foster parent process. But the state hasn't always told grandparents about the help that is available. Now the state is starting to reach out more. But Terry Brooks from Kentucky Youth Advocates says that's not enough.
The state needs to make a much stronger and more consistent commitment to providing those supports like training and like respite care than currently is being done.
Like training and how trauma can influence a kid's behavior. And respite care, basically a babysitter, so people like Caldwell can take a break.
My big vacation for this year was spending a weekend in Harrodsburg, so... So, you know, I got away from the kids for 2 days, but still, I got to rest for a couple days.
For now, Polston and Campbell hope members of their group can babysit for each other so these grandparents can rest up before going back to nonstop parenting. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville. The effects of NAS can be felt throughout the fabric of a community, and little is known about the condition's long-term effects, adding to the challenge for those working to help these children. As Ohio Valley Resources' Aaron Payne reports, educators around Appalachia are doing what they can without knowing just how NAS affects their students or how many are affected.
The school day is over for West Elementary students in Athens, Ohio, but not for Superintendent Tom Gibbs. Each day he makes sure the nearly 3,000 students in his district make it home safely. That's one thing that hasn't changed much during Gibbs' 30 years as an educator, but other things have. Gibbs says that in recent years he's noticed more young students with cognitive and emotional issues.
Where we used to have one child, each preschool group that's coming through, each kindergarten group that's coming through, we might have 3 to 6. So what's difficult for us to ascertain is what is the cause of that.
Gibbs and many other educators around Appalachia believe several factors surrounding the addiction crisis may contribute to the increase, including neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS. In Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia alone, almost 15,000 babies were born exposed to drugs in the womb between 2013 and 2016. Many of these children now attend pre-K through first grade. And while Gibbs can't be sure, he suspects there is a connection.
Our teachers are put in situations where they have to try to react to symptoms as opposed to being able to know what the root cause of the challenges are and being able to create an intervention plan.
West Virginia consistently had the highest rates of NAS births in the nation during the peak of the opioid epidemic. Susan Beck is the State Department of Education's director of the Office of Special Education. She says they have teachers to fill in expanding special education classrooms, but the demand for resources has caused a different type of teacher shortage.
We have special education teachers in every classroom, but it might be that they're not fully certified or that they need to be in a program to get certified in special education.
The state is developing strategies to help these children as early as possible through various partnerships. Early childhood programs help those with identifiable developmental delays from NAS to catch up to their peers before they enter the school system. But Beck says sometimes these children will need continued support. Student assistant teams use what they do know about the effects of NAS on a developing brain to create further interventions.
They identify students as soon as they come through the door if they need it, as to what interventions or help they need.
But educators are working with limited knowledge about the long-term effects of NAS. Dr. Henrietta Botta is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Kentucky and a prominent voice in NAS research. She says it can be difficult to tell what is caused by NAS and what is caused by other factors.
The environment that these kids grow up in are not the best environment. That's when you try to balance the risk of a poor environment, and then what happened to these kids when they were exposed to substances.
Botta says more long-term research is needed. A small study of Australian children indicates students who experienced NAS could have issues through high school. But more recent work out of Tennessee suggests fewer children will need services later on. Botta says while the research continues, it is important to avoid stigmatizing affected children.
Let's not repeat what happened during the cocaine epidemic. They said, oh, they're going to have a lot of malformations and all that stuff. And really, they didn't. They're just like other normal kids.
Tom Gibbs agrees. Day by day, he and other teachers work to address the problem by focusing on the children first.
We don't identify kids by what their deficiencies are. We identify children as children and treat them as part of our school community.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Aaron Payne in Athens, Ohio.
Educators, like those in Athens, aren't the only community members dealing with the opioid crisis. Next, we'll hear from two nurses who were some of the first in the country to figure out some of the ways to treat infants with NAS, and they're right here in Appalachia. Kylie Cook and Carla Saunders are neonatal nurses at a children's hospital in Knoxville, Tennessee, where they've spent decades caring for infants. And at StoryCorps, they remembered when their jobs began to change.
Summer 2010, we had six babies in the nursery who were in withdrawal.
It was so hard to watch these babies. They would have tremors. They're inconsolable. And we couldn't fix it. We couldn't make these babies better. And little did we know, that was the tip of the iceberg. We had 10 and then 15 and then at one point 37 babies in the NICU that were withdrawing. We were bursting at the seams.
We were completely unprepared and short-staffed. And I remember a nurse in tears holding a baby and this baby's just screaming. And she said, "We have got to do something," because what we were doing wasn't working. And here we were, just a small children's hospital in East Tennessee, and these babies were carrying the flag of the substance abuse problem in the United States. And so we went looking to the experts, you know, let's call across the country and let's find out what's the best way to treat these babies. And then that moment of
nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
And who knew that we would become the experts? When you see a baby, especially one that has been in your care for a long time, that has been off the charts in withdrawal, and you've done everything you possibly can, you finally get this baby acting like a normal baby, and then he smiles at you.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that you've made a difference in a mother's life, I mean, that will carry you through the darkest times, knowing that, my gosh, we did this.
I know.
We did this.
That's Kylie Cook and Carla Saunders, nurse practitioners at East Tennessee Children's Hospital, where they helped establish one of the first treatment protocols for babies exposed to opioids, as well as a program connecting mothers with treatment and therapy. Their StoryCorps interview will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. NAS is a tough subject. We've heard about the stigma that moms face. Well, anyone who suffers with substance use disorder, but especially moms. It's sadly very easy to look down in disgust at a person who would expose their unborn child to drugs. I recently attended an event in the northern panhandle of West Virginia where experts discussed how the opioid crisis affects kids. The thoughts of one woman, a pediatrician named Judy Romano, stood out. She spoke about how her passions have shifted over the years, from focusing on how to help NAS babies recover to focusing on helping women be healthy mothers. Romano stressed that creating spaces where women can find help without being judged by doctors or nurses is key.
Getting these women treatment, helping them, again, in a non-judgmental way, get the help that they need, makes all the difference in the world. That keeps these babies out of the foster care system. That keeps these moms out of the child protective services. And it allows them to be the parents that they want to be.
But here's the thing I heard Dr. Romano say that continues to stick with me. Data have revealed there is a window of opportunity where women seem to be able to access incredible strength and motivation to overcome their battles with substance use disorder.
There are multiple programs across the United States that has proven there's something about a woman when she has a substance use problem and she's pregnant. It gives oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes gives her that strength and gives her that desire to do what is right for her baby.
I walked away from this conversation realizing that, strange as it sounds, within the struggle these women face lives a kind of hope, maybe for our entire region, that we can help each other and be inspired by each other to overcome this crisis and maybe even discover and begin to deal with the root causes of addiction that so many of our friends, neighbors, sisters, and mothers face. Maybe. We like to dream big here inside Appalachia. Well, until next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Several of the stories in this episode are part of the series Born Exposed, exploring access to medical and rehabilitative care in Appalachia for opioid-affected women and their babies. Born Exposed is a project of 100 Days in Appalachia, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and the Ohio Valley Resource. The OVR is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. We also had help this week from StoryCorps and Side Effects Public Media. Music in today's show was provided by Matt Jackford, Michael Howard, and Dinosaur Burps. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. I'm Glynis Board. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email, insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Online, you could also sign up for our newsletter, subscribe, or download all of our stories. Look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Jessica Lilly will be back as your host next week. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.